Part 5. Photosphere. Chapter 21. The sun was still 10 degrees above the horizon when I reached the musky ruin. Not much was left of it now, with dust already smothering its lines. But the feature had been well documented and easily mapped from orbit, and it was a prime candidate among our possible rendezvous points. I was glad that the impactor and dropships had not veered too far from their predicted landing zone, because none of the other shelters were as handy as this one, nor as close to the initial objective. It had been a quintet of pressure domes, with one main dome in the middle and four smaller units around it, linked by semicircular tunnels. The domes had long ago ruptured or caved in, so that all that was left was their foundations, and a meter and a half or so of crumbling, curving walls. Anything useful, such as solar collectors, airlocks, or life support systems, had been plundered long ago. These abandoned, crumbling homesteads, there were hundreds more all over Mars, were already fading into invisibility. They had been here only a century or more, but I easily imagined myself crouching among the vine-ridden walls of some jungle temple from 1,000 years earlier. Mars already had a long and bewildering history of ambition, conquest, and abject, harrowing failure. The Muskies, with their cultish, overreaching aspirations, were just one small chapter in that narrative. While the others converged on this position, I set about preparing our temporary camp. I retracted my stilts and set equipment pods on the darkening ground. I unwrapped a 4-meter-wide thermal mat and secured it to the ground with burrowing pitons. Kneeling on the mat, I laid out more tools, weapons, and supplies. Using the walls as cover, I deployed a camouflaged awning, resembling a bigger version of my suit's adaptive parasol. Now even the neutral, vigilant Demarchists would have trouble spotting us from space. The sun had gone down by the time I was done. Without image amplification, it was totally dark under the awning. Totally dark beyond it. There was no air glow. No moonlight. A thin, cold wind whipped and chivied the adaptive fabric. I heard it faintly through my suit's acoustic sensors. Conserving energy, I sat very still with my knees tucked up to my chest. Hope was the first to arrive. My suit alerted me to his approaching footfalls, picking up even the minor seismic signal of the stilts. There was almost nothing to see until he was climbing in through a gap in the wall, crouching into the space under the awning. I studied him through the image amplification overlay, alert for signs of injury or damage. My visor painted a pale purple outline around his form. Our suits established an ultra-short-range comms handshake. Status? I asked. Bruised and battered, but otherwise functional. How was it for you?
Nominal.
Always one for the small talk, Faith.
Small talk won't get us off Mars with the mission objective.
No, but it might make the time pass a little more easily. You know, by the time they extracted me from my last surface mission, I was talking to anything that looked like it had a face.
By all means, talk to yourself. Unless it compromises our operational effectiveness, I don't have a problem with it.
I gestured at the items on the ground. I've commenced the parts inventory. Hope unpacked his own equipment pods and began laying the contents next to the things I had already set out. Weapons, ammunition, suit components, medical instruments, and supplies. Some of the bigger weapons and tools had been split between us. Now their parts could be organized and assembled.
The drop was rougher than the simulations, Hope commented, clicking together the two main sections of an armor-piercing rifle.
Everything's rougher than simulations.
We made it down. If they saw us, or suspected anything, there'll be some activity by daybreak. I sighed down the bore of a magnetic pistol, then snapped it back into its housing.
Any sign of charity?
Hope asked.
Not yet.
The fourth suit?
Not yet.
I carried on organizing our equipment. Charity arrived an hour later, exhausted but relieved to have found the rendezvous. She unpacked her gear, and after a quick inspection we confirmed that it had all arrived, undamaged. Which was good. Each of us had our role to play, but Charity's was the first, and arguably most critical, part of the mission. If it failed, then the operation as a whole was shot.
Rest while you can, I advised her. We're still waiting on the other suit, but even if it arrives soon, we'll need storm cover before we set out.
About the other suit, sir?
Yes.
I think I saw it go down, sir. Something came in very hard about 20 clicks north of my drop point. I don't think it was an ordinary impact or shard. It looked small and sleek, like a dropship, but I didn't see any sign of a slowdown. The horizon line was near, though, so I suppose it might have flared when it was out of sight.
The storm came, and the storm persisted. There was night, and there was night's close cousin. Daylight smothered to a grey, shadowless twilight by the rushing dust clouds. At its fiercest, the storm felt as it might already blanket all of Mars and never surrender its hold. But we knew better. At this season and this latitude, it might only last a day. That would still be enough for us. I was the only one receiving updates from orbit. They were highly encrypted, low-energy transmissions that were being beamed out in all directions, not just down to the surface. If the conjoiners detected these signals, it would not necessarily alert them that an operation was in progress. The content itself was extremely terse, just enough to give us guidance as to whether it was safe to proceed, and what sort of time margin was in force. 12 hours until we lose storm cover, I reported. No other storm of comparable extent predicted for the next 7 days. Hope made a diffident sucking sound. Couldn't be nearer the knuckle. It's sufficient. 5 hours to the objective, 1 on sight, 5 back. Maybe less than 1 on sight, if all goes well. We'll be back under shelter with at least an hour's margin, but only if we leave now. Or sit it out until a longer storm. The longer we delay, the more chance we'll give the spiders to reach the capsule ahead of us. We've planned for this. I turned to Charity. 5 hours will be tough on all of us, and there'll be no chance to stop. It all hangs on you when we get to the defection capsule. I know we're all tired after the drop, but this is probably our only opportunity.
I'm ready, Charity affirmed.
Good. We're depending on you. Almost as an afterthought, I added, by the way, Control confirms your observation, Charity. The 4th dropship malfunctioned at the last moment.
So, no 4th suit, Charity said.
I nodded, examining the spare visor that had come with our supplies. A complication, but we'll find a workaround. Hope, next to me, said nothing. We stowed our inventoried equipment, selected what we would need for this part of the operation, and left the rest in the shelter where the walls would keep off the worst of the dust. The force of the storm was actually very slight. There was no chance of anything being blown over or blown away, but the invasive, scouring dust was a constant problem. It always had been, always would be on Mars. Now we depended on it, for no surveillance capability accessible to the conjoiners should be able to track our movements under the storm's screen. We deployed our stilts and moved out in close formation, guided by the transponder signal from the defection capsule. 2 human faces were there as I emerged from reefer sleep. Lady Arryk had not changed to any noticeable degree, but Glass was a different version of herself. She had become thinner and steelier, the bones around her dark-margined eyes more sharply defined, her skin drawn tighter onto the armature beneath it. I thought of war drums and bowstrings.
Clavain, talk to us.
Give him time, Glass. You forget how hard this is for those without our gifts.
I tried to speak. My tongue felt like some dry, swollen maggot cramming my mouth.
Lady Arryk, Glass.
I blinked some of the gumminess out of my eyes. The lids were stiff canvas, rough against my eyeballs. Everything in me was glued to every other part, as if I had been part mummified in some hard-setting resin.
He remembers names, at least,
Lady Arryk commented to Glass.
More than names. Where are we?
Glass reached in and bundled me out of the casket with as much consideration as if I were a sack of meat with a few old bones tossed in.
What do you remember about our destination?
Mars, I coughed as she rough-handled me. We were going to Mars.
She flung me onto some kind of couch she must have brought alongside the casket.
Not Mars, you bloody fool. Definitely not Mars.
He is confused, Lady Arryk said, with a faint, pitying smile.
Glass slapped my cheek. Concentrate, Clavaine. John the Revelator died.
You remember John the Revelator? For pity's sake, tell me you remember John the Revelator.
Something about... I had to wait while my brain shuttled impulses around its warming loom and dredged up fragments of memory. It was like a cold engine trying to run up to speed.
Gideon Stones.
And on our way to... I grunted, trying to force it out of me.
Albertine. Amduman.
Ararat, Lady Arryk said. I nodded fiercely.
Ararat, where the pattern... The pattern...
Jugglers, she helped.
Pattern, jugglers,
I echoed. To swim with them.
To learn something.
Like a lifting fog, some sort of clarity began to form.
Did we make it to Ararat?
Glass was going to wake up before the rest of us.
I did, Glass said. We're nearly there.
I pressed a finger to my brow, massaging away a knot.
How nearly is nearly? In system, about to complete our slowdown phase. We just need to trim a little more speed, then we can make a ballistic crossing to Ararat.
Tell him the rest, Lady Arryk said. I swung my legs off the couch, forcing mobility into my limbs. There's a problem. If there wasn't, you wouldn't be waking me with this urgency. You said you'd bring us out well in advance of our arrival. An hour or a day, here or there, shouldn't matter if we're still weeks from Ararat.
So what is it?
A problem arose with the integration of the Gideon Stones, Glass said.
Try rephrasing that in something other than the passive voice.
There's a good Glass, said Lady Arryk. Glass shot a glare at her.
I attempted to embed three of the Gideon Stones. If they're to be useful to us, they must work in conjunction with their cryo-arithmetic engines. Unfortunately, there was a conflict.
Lady Arryk chided, and instead of waiting for my counsel, how did you react to this conflict?
I pressed on, because only I have the necessary understanding of this ship's systems.
An understanding that proved lamentably insufficient when put to the test.
Their bickering was worse than the reef asleep revival.
Enough, I said, raising a hand. What happened? Clearly the ship is all right, or we wouldn't be here. Are the stones damaged? The cryo-arithmetic engines?
There has been no lasting damage, Glass said.
Good. But there is a complication, Lady Arryk said. A significant one. We have not been able to arrive at a joint position concerning the best course of action ahead of us.
What about Pinky?
Pinky has declared his opinion, Glass said.
Fine. I'll declare mine, as soon as I know what the hell it is I'm supposed to be declaring one on.
Can you walk, Clavaine? Lady Arryk asked.
Give me a moment. Or several.
She jammed an arm under my left armpit and heaved me off the couch. Glass grunted and took my other side. Between them, they dragged me out of the room while I tried to get my legs to make slippery contact with the floor. They felt like two flimsy tentacles scraping beneath me.
You are right about the ship, Glass said. All systems are now nominal. As you will have noticed, we are in a deceleration configuration.
Barras, probably Rose, and the others. Lady Arryk seemed pleased by my concern.
They are well, but still asleep for now.
It is probably for the best that they remain that way, until we have resolved the complication ahead of us. We shall wake them once we are on Ararat. If all is well, that will be as far as they ever need to travel.
Are there wolves around Ararat?
If there are, they are concealed for now, Glass answered.
The problem is that their presence must be assumed, even in the absence of evidence,
Lady Arryk said.
I nodded.
The ship can run silently if it needs to.
So it would have done, she said. Unfortunately, Glass's experiments have made that impossible.
Tell him. He will hear all of it before long, from your lips or mine.
The system's conflict.
Glass, for once, was tongue-tied.
The conflict I created.
Lady Arryk urged.
Continue. I pressed on when I should have backed away. My tests led to a cascade of failures, and the ship went into a coma, save for life support power. The dark drives defaulted to a fail-safe condition.
In other words, Lady Arryk said, they stopped.
When we should have been slowing down, we were not,
Glass went on.
It took time to bring the ship back to normality. As a consequence, we're now coming in too fast.
Too fast for what? I asked.
To avoid being seen, Lady Arryk said. If we operate the engines at the necessary level to complete our approach to Ararat, we will emit detectable drive products. If there are wolves in the vicinity, they will undoubtedly track us.
We had come to the control room. Pinky was already there, occupying one of the command seats, spooning something into his mouth and reviewing a set of scrolling simulations. The ship had configured its manual controls to suit his fingers. We nodded at each other, two acquaintances who had only lately spoken, and whose last exchange was separated only by a single sleep. That the sleep had taken a decade, and might well have been our last, was, for the moment, immaterial.
How much have they told you, Stink?
That we have to slow down a little more, and it's hard to see how we can do it without making ourselves known to the wolves.
How are you?
Doing well, for a pig.
Then I'm glad.
Outline the proposition, Pinky, if you would be so good.
My great pleasure, your ladyship.
He rubbed at his snout, thoughtfully.
Okay. You settled, Stink. Buckled in?
You'll need to be.
Tell me. We need cover. That's the essence of it, Stink. Some nice moon or planet we can screen ourselves behind while we kill this extra speed Glass has so kindly given us.
I see. But the kicker is, there isn't any moon or planet that works for us. Not with our approach vector the way it is, and not with any reasonable guess as to where wolves might be hiding, if they're here at all.
Wouldn't it be nice if they weren't?
It certainly would, Stink. Still, there is an option on the table. A concealment method works very well under almost any set of assumptions. We use P. Eridani A, the star we used to call Bright Sun.
Good, I said provisionally, certain there was an aspect to this that I was not yet seeing. There's a vector that lets us hide behind the star while we complete our slowdown?
Not quite, Glass said. We won't be employing Bright Sun as a mask. We'll be using the star itself. Scythe has projected a course that allows us to skim close to the star, dip beneath the photosphere, and execute our final slowdown while we're within it.
I laughed. It was the only sane response.
I must have some post-revival confusion. I could have sworn you said, inside the star.
It isn't as bad as it sounds.
No, Pinky said. It's much, much worse.
I regarded Glass. You're not stupid, and I'm reasonably sure you're not suicidal. Explain how this helps us.
Good, Clavaine. At least you're open-minded. The fact is, we're only considering a brief dip into the photosphere of the star. Barely different to skimming the atmosphere of a planet.
Except it's a star.
Don't get too hung up on that.
The photosphere is merely a transitional zone, where the mean free paths for photon collisions undergo a large change. From Scythe's point of view, it will be no different to moving from one plasma environment to a somewhat denser, more excited environment containing the same plasma.
Except it's a star, I repeated.
Inside the photosphere,
Glass continued, undaunted,
the ambient energy background will screen our emissions very effectively. We can complete our slowdown and emerge at the correct speed to make a safe crossing to Ararat. Some thermal transfer will have taken place during the passage, but simulations indicate that it will be within the dissipative capacity of the cryo-arithmetic engines.
Simulations and indicate. Two words to inspire confidence, if ever there were any.
He's as thrilled about it as I was, Pinky said.
I turned to Lady Arryk.
You're at least as smart as Glass. Is any part of this even remotely feasible?
It is not without its challenges, but I have reviewed the same projections as Glass. I believe the proposal to be fundamentally sound.
Now tell him the fun part,
Pinky said. The manoeuvre isn't feasible without a contribution from the Gideon Stones, Glass said. The dynamic loads on Scythe, both from the ambient forces and the deceleration pattern, result in terminal hull collapse under all simulations. Absent the Gideon Stones.
Absent these almost entirely untested Gideon Stones, I said.
Exactly how many did you get to work, Glass, before it all went wrong?
Three. Two, if you wish to split hairs.
And how many will it take to work?
All nine.
I shrugged.
Well, that's no problem at all.
With my assistance in coordinating the integration, Lady Arryk said, it may not be so difficult as the first time. There is also a secondary consideration. The stones must be made to work eventually. If they fail us now, at least we will know that the rest of our plan is hopeless.
All right, I said, sighing my acceptance. That's the extreme option. I don't like it, but I'm prepared to believe that it might work. If Glass and Lady Arryk both work at it.
What's the backup plan?
We abandon our approach, Glass said. Slip through the system at our current speed. Hope that we're not detected. Return to interstellar space. Wait until we've gained enough distance. Then reverse our course.
Which will add time to our rendezvous.
Glass nodded. About 2 years, with an unavoidable margin of uncertainty. And at the end of it, we'll still have to make the Gideon Stones work en masse.
I think I like being late better than I like being burned to a crisp inside a star.
But it's not that simple a comparison, is it?
Any moving object runs a chance of detection, especially passing through the dusty magnetic environment of a solar system, Lady Arryk said. The more times we do it, the greater likelihood of being seen.
I looked back at the scrolling simulations. Give me your honest answer, both of you. If the systems work as they should, is this really something we can survive? I watched Glass for the slightest trace of hesitation or equivocation, but her answer was immediate and firm.
Yes.
Lady Arryk?
It is within our capabilities.
I turned to Pinky. They tell me you've already weighed in.
I have, Stink.
And your position?
I think it would be better if you answered first,
Lady Arryk said. Pinky and I are split on how best to proceed, so your vote will settle things. You may reflect on it for a little while. Our course needs to be modified one way or the other, and the earlier we do it, the smaller the possibility of detection. A decision within the hour would be exceedingly helpful. Not least because there will be work to be done if we go with the sun-skimming manoeuvre.
I could spend 10 hours weighing those alternatives and it wouldn't help.
There is that, Lady Arryk agreed.
If we don't get to Ararat, I don't get to meet my brother. Without the information you expect to learn from him, no other part of our plan has a hope. And without our plan, the wolves will ultimately destroy us. I breathed in. In essence, you're telling me to make a decision which could save or condemn whatever's left of humanity.
No pressure, Stink.
Then I go with my intuition. It's all or nothing. We try to reach Ararat on this path.
Lady Arryk nodded solemnly.
Is that your final decision?
It is. Then to Pinky, I hope you won't resent me for that.
Rolls of frown corrugated his forehead.
Why would I? You just sided with me.
I assumed you'd have regarded this as complete madness.
Because pigs are said to be risk-averse.
Because pigs are sane.
The dissenting opinion was mine, Lady Arryk said. I was moved to reject Glass's plan. I still am. But now the majority has spoken, and I abide by it. You and Pinky have decided our course.
She closed her eyes.
With the engines damped,
Pinky and I suited up and went outside. We floated out of the weightless ship and allowed our momentum to drift us a couple of hundred meters away from the hull before slowing down with suit thrusters. Then we turned around to inspect the transformations that had already been wrought on Scythe. We could just about see the ship. It was a black form against blackness, but faint lusters of highlight played across the form, defining its shape. P. Eridani was a double star, made up of two similar K-type dwarfs. Ararat only orbited one of these stars, P. Eridani A, the so-called bright sun, with the B component always being more distant. Bright sun was obvious to us now, much more luminous than the seemingly smaller and fainter counterpart. But although it was the most obvious thing in the sky, even at our present distance, bright sun only emitted a dim golden pall. Most of the light available to us was coming from the floodlights built into our suits. The ship could have made itself darker still, soaking up all the photons we fired at it, but we were still far enough out to be able to dispense with such precautions. Pinky and I carried the remaining 7 stones, 3 with him and 4 with me. The 2 that had successfully integrated were tiny in comparison to the ship, but they stood out like warts on an otherwise smooth face. I had handled a single stone before, and been shown something of its capabilities. Their real usefulness only came out when they were employed in numbers, though. According to functional principles, Lady Arik and Glass had done their best to explain to me. Each stone had been placed in contact with the skin and allowed to undergo a process of limpet-like attachment, pushing roots deep into the existing hull armor. The stones did this on their own. If I had kept hold of one long enough, it would have tried to anchor itself into me as well. Once so anchored, the stones co-opted some of the ship's local fabric to grow meandering interconnections, linking themselves up, and also searching for a native technology with which to bind and establish a control protocol. Once we were done appraising the hull from a distance, Pinky and I told our suits to take us to separate worksites about 100 meters apart and well out of sight of each other. I clamped on with my boots and dug into a pouch fixed to my chest. I took out one of the remaining stones. Pinky confirmed that he had done likewise. A ruby glow slipped between my fingers. Glass, Lady Arik, I'm ready. Lady Arik called back, Pinky, are you in position? Just getting there. I heard him grunt as he settled onto the hull. I've got the magic pebble. Just say the word. Integration seems to go more smoothly when the stones are introduced synchronously, Lady Arik said. You will lay the 3 remaining pairs at the designated positions, then the 9th and final stone. Hourglass, tell them how to proceed. Offer the stone up to the hull. You need not press too firmly. In fact, it would be advisable to remove your fingers from the attachment site as soon as contact is established.
Why's that? Pinky asked.
Because you may find your fingers useful in later life.
Thank you. Glass. Is there a reason Stink and I drew the short straws on this one?
Lady Arik said, If you feel you have the neural workflow to manage 2 conflicting system integration tasks with an optimum intervention lag on the order of 0.3 seconds, by all means, come on in.
The thing I like about her, Pinky said, is that she's never in a rush to protect my feelings.
I think we're outflanked, Pinky, I said confidingly. Are you ready?
Ready as you are, Stink.
Deploy, Glass and Lady Arik said in unison. I held the stone in both hands, cradling it between my fingers, then almost flung it at the hull. I pulled back, fingertips tingling, as if some part of the Gideon stone's energy had already begun to penetrate them. The stone seemed to have jumped out of my grip, slamming into the hull with some sudden magnetic attraction. It was already anchoring itself, partially submerged into what, only a moment ago, had been almost impermeable armor.
In, I reported.
In,
Pinky confirmed. Good, Lady Arik said. Now proceed to your 2nd installation points. Hourglass and I will commence initial integration of these stones as soon as the tendrils marry with Scythe's avionics.
Take your time,
I said quietly. Pinky and I worked efficiently but carefully, and within an hour we had laid in the last of the four pairs of stones. That left me with the odd one to finish the job. "Do not delay your return to the lock," Lady Arryk said, as I knelt with the stone in my grip. "Something happens with an unpaired stone. It seems to be the factor that encourages the others to begin skein initialization." "Nice to know. Shouldn't Pinky go inside ahead of me?" "We started this together, Stenk," came his voice. "May as well see it through." I pushed the ninth stone nearer the hull until I felt it trying to wriggle out of my fingers. I let it go, the stone speeding out of my grip as if on a sling. It rammed into the hull, and I began my retreat. Pinky and I arrived back at the lock within a second of each other. Once we were within the lock, even with the outer door still open, I assumed we were safe. But our mistresses urged us to cycle through and complete the sealing off of the outer hull. "The skein is surface conformal," Lady Arryk explained. "It will tend to suck itself into any cavity. You would be ill-advised to be inside that cavity when it does." "I like this more by the hour," Pinky said. We came through the lock, back into Scythe. The engines were already coming back on. Glass and Lady Arryk, not wanting to waste a second in which we might be decelerating ahead of our encounter with Bright Sun. We slipped out of our suits, stowed them, and made our way back to the control room. Glass and Lady Arryk barely acknowledged us as we came in. They were already knee-deep in the mental task of initializing the seven new stones. Their backs were arched, their necks rigid, their mouths open, their eyelids fluttering. Ill-matched cousins caught in the same rapturous fit. I was seeing what it meant to be a demi-conjoiner now, how each of them was able to tap into the mental resources of their progenitors, to coordinate and share mental tasks between themselves, yet without dissolving into the absolute hive consciousness of the conjoiners. They had left a schematic of Scythe active, showing the mesh-like connections between the Gideon stones, worming yellow lines, readapting, thickening, and consolidating by the second, like eldritch lightning playing over and around the hull. "Ladies weren't kidding," Pinky said in a low voice. "It's happening quickly. How much did they tell you about all this?"
"Oh, plenty."
He cocked his head, reflecting on his answer.
"How much I understood, different question."
The ship shuddered. Various alarms sounded. On the schematic, the yellow lines had stabilized. But now a secondary influence was asserting itself. A colorless, frosted, scale-patterned membrane was spreading out from each of the stones, clinging to the hull and merging at the contact points between the stones. "The skein?" I asked. "Trying to form, I think." I thought of the pearly, faceted membrane that had bled out of the stone when I was shown it in the stronghold, oozing over my hand, gloving it against the impact of a blade. It spills out from the nodes, becomes a kind of armor sticking close to us. "I don't think we need to know what it is, Pinky. Just that there are a whole range of things that won't be able to get through it. That's the level of understanding that's worked for me for most of my life. It's a sensible philosophy."
"It had better be. It's the only one I've got."
The ship juddered again, but less violently than before, with the alarms becoming more muted. I had the sense that these were merely protestations of irritation as the alien and human technologies came to a grumbling, bad-tempered accord. Lady Arryk jerked and coughed. She was coming out of her trance. On the display, the pearly bloom was thinning and curdling, breaking back down into distinct regions, then sucking back into the Gideon stones.
"We have stable coordination across 9, Lady Arryk said.
"Will 9 do?" I asked. Glass echoed Lady Arryk's emergence. For a second, her eyes were still rolled back in their sockets, as if they had stuck there. She shook her head as if to rattle them loose.
9 will have to."
Glass nodded at the woman beside her.
"You did well. We did well."
"It was taxing," Lady Arryk answered. Her chest heaved as if she had just come up from underwater. "But not unenjoyable.
Between us, we should be able to manage the stones as we pass through the photosphere, Glass said. It won't be easy. The magneto-hydrodynamic loads will require constant adjustment, but it will be fun, Lady Arryk said, tilting her head slightly, as if the word was new to her.
Chapter 22 Bright sun grew larger and brighter by the day. Scythe's windows were able to simulate a perfectly realistic view, and already the star's disk was becoming uncomfortable to stare at for any length of time. Holding my squinting eye to the curdled, storm-ridden boundary, where its glare met the black of space, I marveled at our brilliant madness. We were going into that, dipping ourselves willingly into those molten shallows. And here was the real madness, hoping it wouldn't kill us. Although we were committed to the maneuver, there were still many variables that needed to be considered. Everything was a brutal trade-off. The harder the ship decelerated, the less time it would need to spend in the photosphere, minimizing the load on the Gideon stones and the cryo-arithmetic devices. Above a certain threshold, though, no guarantees could be made for the safety of any of us, including our sleeping passengers. The further we cut into the photospheric layer, which formed a thin, bright rind around the star of about 100 kilometers in depth, the better hope we had of concealment when we performed the slowdown. But then everything else got harder. I was glad that Glass and Lady Arryk had taken it upon themselves to weigh these factors and offer what they considered the least bad option. Neither Pinky nor I quibbled with it. From the moment we dipped into the photosphere until the moment we emerged from it, about an hour would pass. When we touched the photosphere, we would be traveling at about 850 kilometers per second relative to bright sun. By the time we emerged, our speed would have been reduced to a still fast 490 kilometers per second. That was manageable. We could shed that excess with slow, stealthy deceleration measures between the star and Ararat. But to gain that advantage, we needed to decelerate continuously at 10 Gs while inside the photosphere. There was a complication. We couldn't just arrow straight through the star, taking the path of least distance. That would have bored us deep into the convection layer, beyond any hope of survival. Our trajectory had to follow a precise curve, keeping within the incredibly narrow boundary of the photosphere, a margin no thicker than a planet's atmosphere. But since our speed would be so high when we came in, we would be traveling faster than the motion of any object that just happened to be in orbit around the star at the same altitude. The effect of that would be an outward force, far greater than our deceleration burn. Around 104 Gs at the start of the maneuver. That was made slightly more bearable by the star's own gravitational field, acting in the opposite direction, but it was by no means neutralized. Bright sun was less massive than the sun, but also more compact. The result was a surface gravitational acceleration of 34 Gs, meaning our net outward force would be a mere 70 Gs. Against that, our 10 Gs of deceleration was barely consequential. We would feel it only as a slight deflection in the local vertical. But then we wouldn't be feeling anything. Those levels were far beyond any point where consciousness was feasible, even with artificial measures. Even conjoiners were incapable of thinking at 70-plus Gs. But things would get better as we slowed down, and the radial component of our acceleration diminished. 18 minutes into our maneuver, when we passed the midpoint of our journey through the photosphere, the outward G-load would have reduced to just 45 Gs, which, according to Glass and Lady Arryk, was approaching the point where Glass could begin to resume normal cognitive operations, and therefore have both knowledge and influence over the ship. Lady Arryk would follow some while after. But it would be a lonely wait before Pinky and I were able to approach the same functionality. By the time the outward force was reduced to 10 Gs, the same magnitude as our deceleration, another half hour would have passed. Even then we would feel 14 Gs, because by then the deceleration vector was no longer negligible.
The acceleration couches were designed for sustained loads of 3Gs and transient loads of between 10 and 20. Beyond that, we all needed specialized protection and life support measures, including Glass and Lady Arryk. For those of us who were still awake, these turned out to be our suits, already engineered to cushion their hosts against a range of stresses. The suits were normally full of air, but each was capable of immersing their subjects in a dense but breathable fluid. No part of that would be enjoyable, but it would be survivable. As for the evacuees, their reefer sleep caskets could be auto-modified to provide an equivalent degree of protection. Scythe knew what it was being called upon to do, and had taken it upon itself to make the necessary arrangements. The caskets had gained additional footings, rooting them more solidly to the floor. Within them, a dark-tinted gel seemed to have been introduced to fill the space around the bodies, and perhaps provide some support from within. Elsewhere, similar signs of preparation were evident. The ship was steeling itself, reinforcing weaknesses, eliminating superfluous design features, consolidating its maze of rooms and corridors. It was becoming an iron needle, with the sole purpose of slipping through the winking eye of the photosphere. It was a living castle that had begun to gird and buttress itself for war, shedding the fineries of peace. As Bright Sun kept growing, so Glass and Lady Arryk kept refining the simulations, calculating to the second when they were likely to be able to issue their last useful commands. One might last a little longer than the other, but by the time they had both succumbed, the ship would need to be a master of its own fate. They had given it some leeway to deflect its course up and down, steering around any developing storms in the photosphere, or perhaps exploiting them for maximum cover. By the same token, we knew exactly how late we could delay our entry into the suits. Too late, and the cushioning medium would not have time to build up to the necessary support pressure before the 70 Gs came in. The last 2 hours saw Bright Sun swelling to a third of the sky, then half of it. A blinding orange-yellow furnace, as if the end of the universe were a blazing wall. Like nearly any star, it only looked calm and unchanging from a distance. This close, its surface had become a storm-tossed sea of prominences and rifts, with vast convection cells welling up from beneath. Scythe went into freefall for its final approach, and at 30 minutes before contact, Pinky and I took refuge in the suits, with Glass and Lady Arryk monitoring. The immersion fluid lapped into my mouth, into my throat and nasal passages. No part of my body was yet ready to give in to drowning, and the gag reflex was beyond any conscious control. I convulsed several times before succumbing to the inevitable. Glass came through.
"Can you hear me, Clavaine?"
"Yes."
"Good. You'll start feeling drowsy very shortly. The suit will use mechanical and electrical intervention to keep you alive. So don't be surprised when you wake up with a few cracked ribs and a headache the size of a solar system. Since you don't have to do anything except survive, unconsciousness need not concern you.
In other words, I'm baggage."
"Valuable baggage," Glass said, as if that were meant to make me feel better.
On the long fall in from the last 1,000,000 kilometers, the stresses on Scythe continued to mount. The bulk of it was thermal. To begin with, the conventional materials and cooling systems of the ship were easily able to re-radiate the heat, but not without cost. Within a vacuum, a re-radiant object could only stay cool by glowing, and to glow was to make oneself known. The background temperature of space was a little under 3 Kelvin above absolute zero. A ship only had to stand out against that by 1 or 2 Kelvin to make itself a very tempting target. So, long before we needed them, the cryo-arithmetic engines had already spun up to algorithmic speed, performing acts of occult calculation. By moving symbols around, playing checkers with the basic informational granularity of local space-time, the engines were able to swindle the incorruptible bookkeeping of classical and quantum thermodynamics. The individual cheats were subtle and brought almost no gain,
but the cryo-arithmetic engines ran them over and over again, thrashing through the same cycles, until the effects became first measurable and then macroscopic. It worked, but the nearer we got to Bright Sun, the more furiously the engines had to compute, and the closer they came to a feared instability, a cliff edge beyond which their algorithmic cycles became self-reinforcing, self-accelerating. It was said that a ship succumbing to this condition opened a mouth inside itself to the winds of hell, a mouth that might never close. It was down to Lady Arik and Glass to push the cryo-arithmetics all the way to that brink, but never once over it. No cryo-arithmetic engines had ever had to work so hard as those of Scythe. Normally, all they were asked to do was cool areas of a ship by a few hundred Kelvin. Now the demand was for thousands of degrees, and the cooling gradient was inversed. It no longer mattered how hot the outside of the ship got. There was no chance of detecting it now, within the gathering howl of the photosphere. But the inside had to remain cool enough not to overload the hundreds of life support devices, each of which contained a warm, salty bag of water and cells with a mind and memories. As Scythe dipped into the photosphere, it was hitting an atmosphere of entirely ionized particles. Ships encountered plasmas all the time, and mostly sailed through them without consequence. Indeed, we had already descended through a coronal plasma that was hundreds of thousands of times hotter than the photosphere. But while the temperature of the particles in that plasma might have been high, meaning that each had an enormous kinetic energy, there were not nearly enough of them in a given volume to begin overwhelming our systems. It was not like that, down in the photosphere. There, the temperature was a modest 5,000 Kelvin, but the heat capacity of a given volume was far greater. We were flying through a medium with a particle density comparable to a breathable atmosphere at sea level, except that it was as hot as a furnace, and we were passing through it at hundreds of kilometers per second. I saw us. In my mind's eye, I looked down from above the photosphere into a blinding sea. A black, needle-sharp form arrowed through that sea, parting it like a hypodermic. Mac cones swept back from its tip and tail, barbs of savage shock. They made me think of feathered plumes, diamond-patterned. A curdled wake, tens of thousands of kilometers long, followed our passage. At its boundary it became fractal, consumed in diminishing recursive iterations. But the sea was ever-seething and soon swallowed any trace of us. The cryo-arithmetic engines were safeguarding Scythe from the heat of the star, but it took the Gideon stones to armor the ship against the pressure and shock of moving through the photosphere. The problem was that these two forms of defense tended to squabble, and it took a pair of human minds, or at least a pair of augmented minds, to resolve each knot of discord before it engulfed the ship. When the stones and the engines tussled, one or both had to be adjusted, backed off, or sometimes strengthened. If an error were made, an instability allowed to propagate, the ship would have all the durability of a moth's wing touching fire. And all the while this was happening, every other system of the ship had to operate at its limit, including the conjoiner drives, pushed as hard into the red as was ever the case. But the engines only gave us 10 Gs of deceleration along our line of flight. They were insufficient to provide the 70 Gs of downforce needed to maintain that curving path. That component came from the magneto-hydrodynamic interaction of Scythe's hull with the plasma, with the ship using its engine spars as control surfaces. Without the Gideon stones, Glass had assured me, the spars would have buckled and torn away under the load, taking the engines with them. Then our difficulties would have been of an entirely different complexion, but at least they would have been mercifully brief. I dreamed of a beach, a flat, black beach, stretching limitlessly, and a lone figure buckled nearly to the horizontal as they stooped against the wind, a wind as luminous and scalding as molten metal, searing the eye until the figure melted away into the whiteness, diminishing to a little star-shaped speck, and then flaking away into scouring white oblivion.
"Clavain, stop mumbling," Hands were easing me out of the suit. I let them. I had no power to either resist or assist them. I was a sack of body parts, a grisly mess held together by pain and stubbornness, and the distant, nagging sense that I still had unfinished business.
"Where?"
I said, too weary to frame my word as a question.
"We're out.
On our emergence trajectory. Scythe is weightless now, but we have more than enough speed to escape the gravity well. Once the ship has run a self-repair cycle on itself, fixing damage from the stresses we accrued in the photosphere, I will begin our gradual slowdown for Ararat. Our atmospheric entry interface will be in approximately 53 hours.
I'm all right.
Thank you.
I didn't ask. You are conscious. Therefore, the suit did its job. Do your ribs hurt?
There's no part of me that doesn't hurt. How's Pinky?
Unconscious for the time being. We'll keep him that way for now. He's going to need to be strong when we get to Ararat, for your sake, because there'll be a limit to my effectiveness. Now, we need to talk about Lady Alec.
Through everything, I still managed to frown. A little warm spark flaked away from bright sun. This was not unusual. Tongues of plasma were lifting from the surface all the time, snagged in pincers of magnetic flux. Sometimes they fell back. On other occasions they broke off into phlegmatic fragments, coughed all the way into space. For a little while, as it rose, that warm spark gave no indication that it was anything other than one of these spitballs of stellar material, destined to thin out and cool, and eventually lash its way across the magnetic fields of the planet's orbiting bright sun. Nothing about it was odd or distinctive enough to warrant further interest. The blob cooled, but it did not disperse. It was our ship, rapidly chilling itself back down to 2.7 Kelvin above absolute zero. By the time it broke free of the star's chromosphere, it had become undetectably dark and cold, and even as its propulsion system cycled back to readiness, they did so stealthily, emitting nothing that could be detected by human or wolf faculties. Inside that ship, still weightless, Glass and I floated in seated positions facing each other, while my friend Scorpio remained in his suit.
"Something happened as we were completing our slowdown," Glass said. "An instability developed in the interplay between the stones and the cryo-arithmetic engines, more than we could neutralize. A flutter on the outside of the ship, magnifying instead of diminishing. The stresses increased. The conflicting influences put a torsional load on the hull, and a stone began to detach, peeling away from its anchorage. It was the ninth, the one we placed last of all."
"You said 9 stones would suffice. I'm sure with your talents you could have found a way to make do with 8.
And now we must, because 8 is all we have left."
Glass composed herself. She was more rattled, more distraught than I had ever known her.
"It was not just the fear of losing 1 stone. Unless there was an intervention, there was a danger of the loose stone ripping the others away as it detached. We could not allow that, would not allow it. One of us had to go outside, Clavain, out onto the hull, during the photospheric passage. One of us had to rescue the stone, or cut it away sacrificially before it took the rest. And Lady Alec went."
"No one could have survived going outside, Glass.
We were inside a star." "It was survivable, provided Lady Alec moved quickly. It was survivable."
She repeated it, as if to assert the fact of it against her own crumbling judgment.
"It was survivable.
If the suit remained in contact with the hull, the armoring skein would have conformed to its surface, protecting Lady Alec against the plasma shock. The cooling demands on the suit would have been extreme, but so long as it maintained thermal contact with the ship, the cryo-arithmetic engines would have taken over most of the refrigeration burden."
"Glass, don't tell me you sent another human being outside while we were inside a star. Don't tell me you ever thought this was sane. One of us had to go."
"Why the hell couldn't you have sent a suit or a drone?"
"Autonomy was needed. The plasma would have blocked any control signals. Sometimes you just have to send meat
in a tin. She's not meat. We're all meat. One of us had to remain to coordinate the stones as they readjusted to the intervention. We debated, Clavain, traded scenarios, formed a dueling adversarial network. Each tried to convince the other we were right.
Glass shook her head in wonder, but she triumphed over me. She was best suited to going outside, and I was best suited to controlling the ship. No ambiguity, no doubt, no hard feelings. This wasn't about courage or sacrifice or nobility. It was about functional usefulness.
We're here, I said slowly, and you said we're on our way to Ararat. So whatever happened out there, we didn't die. My voice broke on rising anger. So what the hell happened? How is it we are here and Lady Arik isn't?
We were in contact. Neural exchange. But the packets were fragmenting the further she got from the lock. She was struggling against the plasma front, moving towards the instability. We were inside each other's heads, Clavain. In those last few seconds, she opened up more of herself to me than I ever saw before. As if she trusted me, finally. As if she knew.
That she wasn't going to make it.
She must have reached the ninth stone in time to cut it loose. That's all I know. Scythe detected.
What?
Scythe detected something falling away from it. Very quickly. Falling away into the plasma.
Glass reached around her back and retrieved something that she must have had clipped to her waist. It was a Boza pistol. She pressed it into my fingers. I closed them around its cold, weightless heft. There's a point to this.
I've set the yield to an appropriate setting. It won't do any damage to the ship. Just to me. I've disabled any intervention protocols.
I'm not going to kill you.
Why not? Isn't that what you want?
Before I could react, for all her infirmity, Glass was still fast. She had grabbed my wrist and twisted my arm so that the gun was aimed directly at her forehead.
Do it. Kill me. Kill me again.
I won't.
Do it.
No.
I let Lady Arik die. My mistake in the first place. My errors.
You weren't to know.
I knew what I was doing to you. I destroyed everything you cared for. I stole your life away. The moment you had happiness, I crushed it. I ripped you away from the people you loved and who loved you, and you promised to kill me for it.
Her voice became a snarl.
So do it!
I tried to deflect the pistol, but Glass was stronger. I'm not going to kill you.
Not now. You made a vow.
No, I didn't. I breathed in hard. Every part of me shaking except my hand and wrist, which remained in her grasp.
I didn't.
A dead man made that vow. He's gone now. I paused, shuddering from within. I was never him. I started weeping, fiercely and uncontrollably. Whatever I am, it's not the good man who made that vow. I swallowed. Used my other hand to scrape the tears from my eyes. What is it you want from me, Glass? What did I ever do to you? What the hell did you mean by kill me again?
You murdered me once. Left me for dead. But it turns out not quite dead enough. Now, all I'm asking is that you do the job properly.
She nodded, her eyes meeting mine encouragingly.
Go ahead, Clavain. Finish it off.
No. There was a finality in my answer that must have persuaded her. Glass moved my hand aside, took the Boza pistol back.
You won't do it now?
Not ever?
No.
I needed to know. I thought that this was the simplest way. Glass reached out again, but instead of pinning my hand, she drew me into her, hugging me close, showing no consideration for my bruised or fractured ribs. I wrapped my arms around Glass, and between us we stilled the tremors running through our bodies.
What are we?
I asked.
Two ragged soldiers,
Glass said,
a long way from the war that made us.
You're not as angry with me as I thought you'd be, I said to Pinky, after I had helped him out of reefer sleep and explained the bare facts of our situation. Why would I hold you responsible for this, Stink? He asked, looking at me oddly. It's all because of me, us being here. It's on me in the end. I didn't ask for it, but that doesn't mean I'm absolved of responsibility. Some of it's on you, he admitted thoughtfully, but not all of it. This was Glass's screw-up, all along. If she hadn't messed around with those stones, we'd never have needed to do any dumb shit like trying to fly through a star.
Lady Arryk always thought it was unwise.
It was.
It's not right that she's the one who ended up paying for it.
There we're on the same page, Stink. But I've got some news for you. Universe doesn't give a damn about what's fair and right, and Lady Arryk knew that better than any of us.
He paused, shook his head.
No, it's not all on you, not this time. And you know why you can be sure of that?
No.
He looked down at his wrists. Because I've got two good hands, and you're still breathing.